A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Sir Daniel's been running spectral analysis on the jackhammer outside his bedroom, and he's got a number now, 120 hertz, plus or minus 5. That's the whole acoustic signature of the thing that's been driving him up the wall.
And that's a remarkably tight cluster for construction noise. Most impact equipment is broadband chaos, but this is almost a pure tone.
His questions, as I read them, does knowing the exact frequency range actually help with mitigation? Could whole room active noise cancellation just play the opposing range? What does the window's failure at this specific frequency tell us about soundproofing in general? And why is this thing audible indoors all day, every day?
All day, every day. That's the detail that sticks with me. That's not a crew taking breaks. That's something running continuously.
So today we're going to dig into what a 120Hz signature actually tells us. About the noise, about the room, and about the physics of stopping it.
And I want to start with the wavelength because 120 Hz isn't a random number. It's a specific physical scale. Speed of sound in air, about 343 meters per second. Divide by 120. You get roughly 2.8 meters.
So the wave itself is nearly 3 meters long.
Which is about the size of a bedroom wall. That's the first clue that this is going to be hard to stop. A high-pitched noise, say 2,000 Hz, has a wavelength of about 17 centimeters. Tiny. Easy to reflect, easy to absorb. A 2.8-meter wave doesn't even notice your window.
The window's just a minor inconvenience to a wave that size.
Right. And this is where the mass law comes in and where most people's intuition about soundproofing falls apart. The mass law says that every time you double the mass of a barrier, you gain about 6 decibels of transmission loss. That works beautifully at high frequencies.
But at low frequencies, something else takes over.
Below a certain frequency, the panel stops behaving like a mass and starts behaving like a spring, or a drum head. The stiffness of the panel dominates, and the transmission loss drops off a cliff. A typical single-pane window might give you 40 decibels or more of isolation at 1,000 Hz. At 120 Hz, you're looking at 20 to 25 decibels, maybe less.
So the window is doing a third of the work it does against higher frequencies.
And there's a second phenomenon that makes it even worse. And this one is almost maliciously specific to Daniel's situation. It's called the coincidence effect. At certain frequencies, the wavelength of the sound in air matches the bending wave speed of the panel itself. When that happens, the panel resonates sympathetically. It's like pushing a child on a swing. You hit the natural rhythm and the panel just sings along.
And for glass, where does that coincidence dip land?
For typical window glass, the coincidence frequency often falls in the 100 to 200 Hz range, right where Daniel's jackhammer lives. So the window isn't just failing to block the sound, it's actively coupling with it. The glass is vibrating like a loudspeaker diaphragm at 120 Hz and re-radiating the sound into the bedroom.
Which explains why opening and closing the window barely changes what he hears. He measured both, and the window's specifically failing at this range. It's not a seal problem. It's not a gap under the frame. It's the glass itself.
Sealing helps with high-frequency leakage, the hiss and the clatter. But at 120 Hz, the sound is transmitting through the material, not around it. You could caulk every seam and replace every gasket, and the tone would still come through.
And then there's the structure-borne component. Daniel mentioned a little bit of vibration traveling through the building itself.
Which is the third path, and it bypasses the window entirely. The jackhammer's impact energy goes into the ground, travels through the foundation, up the walls, and radiates into the room from the surfaces themselves. That's not airborne sound at all. It's mechanical vibration that becomes sound only when it reaches the room.
So even a perfect window, a hypothetical one that blocks all airborne sound, would still leave him hearing the structure-borne component.
Right. And that's the thing about low-frequency noise in urban environments. It's a three-path problem. Airborne through the window, airborne through the walls, and structure-borne through the frame. most mitigation strategies only address the first one.
Let's talk about why the noise is clustered at 120 Hz in the first place. A jackhammer's impact rate is typically 20 to 30 Hz, isn't it?
The fundamental impact rate, yes. A pneumatic hammer might strike 25 times per second, but the acoustic energy we hear is dominated by harmonics and resonances. The tool body, the ground coupling, the air cavity, and the hammer mechanism, all of these have natural frequencies. A tight cluster at 120 Hz suggests a specific mechanical resonance, not just random impact noise.
So the 120 Hz is a fingerprint of the machine, not a fingerprint of the construction site.
It's a signature, and that's actually useful information because it tells you the source is periodic and resonant. It's not random. It's a machine doing the same thing over and over at the same frequency, which, in theory, makes it more predictable. And predictability is the one thing you need for active noise cancellation.
Which brings us to Daniel's first instinct, whole room active noise cancellation. He knows the frequency, so why not just play the opposite?
And this is where I have to be careful, because I've been excited about active noise control for years, and I want it to work. But the physics of a room makes it brutally hard.
Walk me through it.
In headphones, active noise cancellation works because the microphone is a centimeter from your ear, and the speaker is a centimeter from your ear. The sound field is simple. One wave, one direction, one point of cancellation. You sample the noise, invert the phase, play it back, and at that single point in space, the two waves cancel.
And a room isn't a single point in space.
A room is a diffuse sound field. The noise reflects off every surface. Each reflection arrives at a different time, with a different phase. At any given point in the room, the sound is the sum of dozens of waves coming from every direction, and the pattern changes as you move. A few centimeters to the left, the phase relationships are different.
So you cancel the noise at one point, and you just made it louder at another point.
Potentially, yes. Active noise control in a room doesn't eliminate sound, it redistributes it. You create zones of quiet and zones of constructive interference, and the zones are small, on the order of a fraction of a wavelength. At 120 Hz, with a 2.8 meter wavelength, your quiet zone might be 30 or 40 centimeters across.
So Daniel would need to keep his head in exactly the right spot all night.
And the system would need to track the noise in real time, not just the frequency, but the phase and amplitude at every moment. The jackhammer's phase at the bedroom window depends on the distance from the source, the temperature of the air, the wind, the reflections off neighboring buildings. It's not a static signal, it's drifting constantly.
And Daniel's measurement showed plus or minus 5 Hz of variation. That sounds small, but in phase terms?
A 5 Hz drift means the phase relationship between the noise and any cancellation signal is constantly slipping. You'd need a control loop that can track that drift in milliseconds. That's doable in a headphone with a dedicated DSP chip. In a room with multiple microphones and multiple speakers, it's a research problem.
I remember reading something from Ascentech, the acoustics firm, that basically said whole room active noise control is still a research topic, not a commercial product.
They've been working on it for decades. The classic application is duct noise, where the sound is confined to a pipe and the wave is essentially one-dimensional. That works. You can cancel a fan tone in a duct with a well-placed speaker and a microphone, but a room is three-dimensional and the sound field is diffuse. The complexity scales enormously.
So Daniel's instinct was right. The frequency information is exactly what you'd need, but the room itself is the problem.
The room is the problem. And there's a deeper issue, too. Even if you could cancel the airborne sound at one point, the structure-borne vibration would still be shaking the walls and radiating sound from the surfaces themselves. The cancellation field would have to account for sound coming from every wall, not just the window.
So what does knowing the frequency actually buy him?
It buys him a diagnostic tool. The fact that the noise is tightly clustered at 120 Hz tells him several things. First, the source is a specific machine with a specific resonance, not general construction chaos. Second, the window's poor performance at that frequency is a physics problem, not a maintenance problem. Third, the structure-borne component is real and measurable, which means he can track it over time.
So the measurement tells him where to focus, even if it doesn't give him a magic bullet.
Right. And the practical mitigation options follow from the physics. If the window is the weak point for airborne sound, you add mass to the window. a second pane with an air gap or a mass-loaded vinyl layer. But here's the catch. At 120 Hz, the air gap needs to be wide, and the mass needs to be substantial.
How substantial?
To get a meaningful improvement at 120 Hz, you're talking about a laminated glass unit with a thick interlayer, or a secondary glazing system with a gap of at least 100 mm. And even then, the coincidence effect might still bite you, because laminated glass can have its coincidence dip in the same range.
That's the cruel irony. The material you'd use to add mass might resonate at exactly the frequency you're trying to block.
Which is why acoustic engineers spend so much time on this. You have to design the window as a system, not just a pane. The glass thickness, the interlayer, the air gap, the frame stiffness, all of it interacts. And the structure-borne path is still there underneath everything.
What about a tuned absorber? A Helmholtz resonator designed specifically for 120 Hz.
That's a legitimate approach for a pure tone. A Helmholtz resonator is essentially a bottle, a cavity with a neck. Air in the neck acts as a mass, air in the cavity acts as a spring. You tune it to a specific frequency, and it absorbs energy at that frequency by resonating. The problem is the size.
How big are we talking?
A quarter wavelength resonator at 120 Hz is about 70 centimeters deep. A practical Helmholtz resonator tuned to that frequency needs a volume on the order of a tenth of a cubic meter. That's a box the size of a small refrigerator hanging on the wall.
So Daniel could have a dedicated 120 Hz absorption unit in the bedroom. Hannah would love that.
And it'd only address the airborne component. The structure-borne vibration would still be there.
Which brings us to the structure-borne path. Is there anything to be done about that?
In a retrofit situation, almost nothing. The proper solution is isolation at the source or isolation at the foundation, which means rubber mounts or spring systems in the building structure. You can't retrofit that into an existing building without major work.
So the structure-borne component is essentially permanent.
For practical purposes, yes. But here's the thing about Daniel's measurement. He's quantified it. He knows there's a structure-borne component, and he can estimate its relative contribution. That's not nothing. It tells him that even a perfect window replacement would only partially solve the problem.
Which is valuable information before spending thousands on new glazing.
The measurement is a diagnostic. It tells you what fraction of the problem is airborne and what fraction is structural. If the airborne component dominates, a window upgrade might be worth it. If the structural component dominates, you're better off investing in masking or just accepting it.
And the fact that it's audible all day, every day, that's another diagnostic clue.
A jackhammer that runs continuously is unusual for construction. Crews take breaks, they move around, they shut down at the end of the day. A continuous 120 Hz tone suggests something else. A compressor, a pump, a generator, some kind of industrial equipment running on a steady cycle.
Which would explain the tight frequency clustering. Construction impact noise is broadband. A running machine has a specific resonant signature.
And if it's a machine rather than a jackhammer, the mitigation calculus changes. Machines are predictable. They run at a constant speed, a constant frequency. That's the one scenario where active noise control might actually work, because the signal is stable enough to track.
But we already established that whole room ANC is a research problem.
For a diffuse sound field, yes, but there's a narrower application. If the source is a steady tone and the room geometry is fixed, you could potentially use a small array of speakers and microphones to create a quiet zone around a specific listening position. Not the whole room, but a chair or a bed.
A personal quiet zone.
That's the term, and it's been demonstrated in lab settings. The challenge is that it requires real-time adaptation to the room's acoustics, and the quiet zone is small and fragile. Move your head 30 centimeters and you're out of it.
So it's not a consumer product, but it's not science fiction either.
It's on the edge, and the frequency matters here. At 120 Hz, the wavelength is long enough that the quiet zone is bigger than it'd be at higher frequencies. A 2.8 meter wave gives you a cancellation zone that might be 40 or 50 centimeters across. At 2,000 Hz, it'd be a few centimeters.
So 120 Hz is actually a relatively favorable frequency for ANC, if you can solve the room problem.
And that's the thing. The physics cuts both ways. Low frequencies are hard to block passively, but they're easier to cancel actively because the wavelength is long and the phase changes slowly over space. High frequencies are easy to block passively, but hard to cancel actively, because the phase changes over millimeters.
So the ideal solution might be a hybrid passive isolation for the high frequencies, active cancellation for the low frequency tone.
And that's exactly where the research is heading. There's work on active acoustic windows, where the window itself has transducers that vibrate in opposition to the incoming low-frequency sound, turning the glass into an active barrier. It's not commercial yet, but the physics is sound.
A smart window that cancels the jackhammer.
The window becomes the speaker. It senses the incoming pressure wave and vibrates out of phase, so the transmitted component is reduced. It's elegant, because the window is already in the path of the sound. You're not trying to cancel sound in a diffuse room, you're canceling it at the point of transmission.
Which sidesteps the whole diffuse field problem.
The cancellation happens at the barrier, not in the room. The sound field on the other side is still diffuse, but if the barrier itself is actively reducing transmission, the energy never gets into the room to begin with.
So, Daniel's measurement is actually pointing toward a future solution. He's identified the exact frequency where the window fails, and an active window would be tuned to exactly that.
And the fact that the noise is a tight cluster at 120 Hz makes it an ideal candidate for a resonant approach. You don't need broadband cancellation. You need to cancel a single, narrow frequency band. That's a much easier engineering problem.
So, the frequency information matters, just not in the way Daniel initially hoped. It's not about playing the opposite sound from a speaker in the corner. It's about understanding where the energy is, and engineering the barrier itself to reject it.
And the other practical takeaway is about masking. If you can't eliminate the tone, you can make it less perceptible by changing the signal-to-noise ratio in the room.
Explain that.
A pure tone at 120 Hz is very noticeable because it's a single steady pitch. The ear locks onto it. But if you introduce broadband noise, like a fan, the tone gets buried in the background. The overall sound level might actually be higher, but the perception of the tone drops dramatically.
So you're not reducing the noise. You're reducing the annoyance.
And annoyance is the thing that keeps you awake. A steady fan at 40 decibels might be less bothersome than a 35 decibel tone at 120 Hz because the tone is information. It's a signal. The brain can't ignore it.
That's a very different approach than trying to block the sound.
And it's often the cheapest and most effective one. A good fan, or a white noise machine, or even a phone app that generates pink noise. It doesn't eliminate the jackhammer, but it changes the acoustic context so the jackhammer stops being the dominant feature.
Daniel's measurement gives him the frequency. He knows it's 120 Hz. He could even generate a masking sound that's specifically designed to cover that band.
And that's a legitimate use of the spectral data. You don't need to cancel the tone, you just need to make it less salient. A masking signal with energy in the 100 to 150 Hz range would do that.
Let's talk about the measurement itself. He used Phibox, which is a physics sensor app. It uses the phone's accelerometer and microphone to take measurements.
The fact that he got a clean spectral analysis from a phone app is impressive. A few years ago, you'd need a dedicated spectrum analyzer for that. Now, it's a free download.
He used AI to analyze the export, which is a very Daniel move. Take the raw data, feed it to a model, get a clean interpretation.
The model identified the tight clustering at 120 Hz. That's the kind of pattern recognition that's useful. A human looking at a spectrogram might see a blob. The model extracts the specific frequency and the variation.
The workflow is measure with the phone, export the data, analyze with AI, get a number, and that number is the fingerprint of the noise.
Now he's got something he didn't have before. He knows the enemy. It's not just construction noise, it's a 120 Hz tone with a 5 Hz variation. That's a specific, quantifiable problem.
Which is strangely satisfying, even if it doesn't solve the problem.
There's real psychological value in that. The noise goes from being this overwhelming, diffuse annoyance to being a specific frequency you can name. It's the difference between I'm being driven crazy by noise and I'm being driven crazy by a 120 Hz resonance.
It's the data-driven approach to suffering.
It's useful for the next step. If he takes the same measurement at different times of day, he can see if the frequency shifts. If it's rock steady at 120 Hz all day, that's a machine. If it drifts, that's something else.
The frequency is a diagnostic for the source.
a jackhammer being operated by a crew would show variation as they move around, hit different materials, change the angle. A compressor, or a pump, would be locked to its operating frequency. The measurement can tell you which one you're dealing with.
That matters for mitigation. A construction crew will eventually finish. A compressor might run for years.
Which is why the all-day, everyday detail is so important. That's not a crew, that's infrastructure.
Daniel's next measurement should be at different times, looking for frequency drift. That would tell him whether the source is variable or fixed.
If it's fixed, the case for some kind of active or resonant solution gets stronger. A fixed frequency source is the easiest possible target for any kind of tune mitigation.
What about the window itself? He measured open versus closed, and the window is failing at this specific frequency. Is there a window upgrade that would actually help?
At 120 Hz, the best practical option is a secondary glazing system with a wide air gap. The air gap acts as a spring, and the combination of two panes with the air between them creates a mass, spring mass system that can be tuned to reject low frequencies.
But the gap has to be wide.
For 120 Hz, you'd want at least 100 millimeters, ideally more. That's a substantial secondary window, not a thin plastic film. And the panes need to be different thicknesses, so they don't share the same coincidence frequency.
Because if both panes resonate at 120 Hz, you've made it worse.
You've created a resonant system at exactly the frequency you're trying to block. The two panes would couple through the air gap and transmit the sound more efficiently. That's the exact failure mode of a poorly designed, double-glazed unit.
The window solution is thick glass, different thicknesses, wide gap, and even then, the structure-borne component is still there.
Which is why I keep coming back to the measurement. Daniel's data tells him what fraction of the problem is airborne and what fraction is structural. If the structural component is significant, the window upgrade is a partial fix at best.
He'd be spending a lot of money for a partial fix.
Which is the reality of low-frequency noise in urban environments. There's no complete fix. There's mitigation, and there's acceptance.
Let me ask you something. The coincidence effect, where the glass resonates, is that something you can actually see or feel?
At 120 Hz, you might feel the glass vibrating if you put your hand on it. The displacement is tiny, on the order of micrometers, but the surface area is large, so the radiated sound can be significant.
The window is literally shaking in sympathy with the jackhammer.
It's a passive radiator. The incident sound pressure drives the glass into vibration, and the glass re-radiates the sound into the room. It's not just transmitting the sound, it's amplifying the specific frequency where it resonates.
Which is why the closed window doesn't help much. The glass is doing the work of the noise.
At the coincidence frequency, the window is acoustically transparent. It's as if it's not there at all.
That's a grim thought for anyone trying to sleep.
It explains why so many people are disappointed by expensive window upgrades. They buy the best double glazing on the market, and the low-frequency rumble still comes through. The sales brochure shows a 40 decibel improvement, but that's measured at 1000 Hz. At 120 Hz, the improvement might be 5 decibels.
The marketing is technically true, but practically misleading.
The transmission loss curve isn't flat. It's high at high frequencies, and it falls off at low frequencies. The coincidence dip makes it worse at specific frequencies. If your noise is at those frequencies, the window's overall rating doesn't matter.
Daniel's measurement is essentially a transmission loss test for his specific window and his specific noise.
That's the right way to think about it. He's not interested in the window's performance across the spectrum. He's interested in its performance at 120 Hz, and the answer is poor.
Which is a much more useful piece of information than the window's brochure rating.
It's the difference between a generic spec and a specific diagnosis. The window is failing at 120 Hz because of the coincidence effect and the mass law. That's not a defect. It's physics.
What's the actual takeaway for Daniel? He's got his measurement, he's got his frequency, he's got his window data. What does he do tomorrow?
Tomorrow, he takes another measurement at a different time of day. If the frequency is rock steady at 120 Hz, he's dealing with a fixed machine, and the long-term strategy might be different than if it's a construction crew.
And in the meantime?
In the meantime, a fan. A good, loud fan. Broadband noise that masks the tone and makes it less salient. It's not elegant, but it works.
The low-tech solution, while the high-tech solution is still in the lab.
That's the honest answer. The physics of low-frequency noise is brutal. The solutions are either expensive, partial, or experimental. But the measurement is the first step, because it tells you what you're actually fighting.
Daniel now knows he's fighting a 120 Hz resonance, not a generic jackhammer.
Which is a strange kind of victory, but it's a victory.
I know someone who might have a story about this exact frequency.
120 Hz. That's the sound of a concrete crusher running all night next to a data center in Secaucus.
Go on.
1979. I was doing night security at the facility. The break room was a prefab trailer bolted to the asphalt, and the crusher next door never stopped. Same frequency, 120 Hz, day and night. The trailer walls did nothing.
Did you measure it?
I had a Radio Shack sound level meter and a cassette recorder. I'd record the hum and play it back at half speed to try to figure out the pitch. Then I got one of the first portable spectrum analyzers, a Heathkit kit I built myself. The trace was a spike at 120 Hz with a little shoulder at 60. The 60 was the motor. The 120 was the crusher jaw.
You had a harmonic relationship. The 60 Hz motor driving a mechanism that resonated at double the frequency.
That's what the engineer from the crusher company said. He came out to look at the vibration and told me the jaw mechanism had a natural frequency right at 120. The motor was fine. The machine was just built that way.
You were trying to sleep in the trailer.
6 months. I built a bass trap out of cardboard boxes stuffed with fiberglass insulation, stacked them in the corner, did nothing. The sound was coming through the floor, not the walls.
Structure born.
The trailer was bolted to the asphalt. The crusher was 50 feet away on a concrete pad. The vibration went through the ground, up the bolts, into the trailer frame. The walls were vibrating. The floor was vibrating. My cot was vibrating.
What did you do?
I bought a box fan from a hardware store on Route 3, put it next to the cot. The fan made enough broadband noise that the tone stopped standing out. I slept fine after that.
Masking, not cancellation.
The tone was still there. I could hear it if I listened for it. But the fan gave my ears something else to lock onto. It's not about making the noise go away. It's about making it stop being the only thing in the room.
And the spectral plots.
I still have them. Rolled up in a tube somewhere. The spike at 120, the shoulder at 60. Same signature as your man's jackhammer. Makes me wonder if it's not a jackhammer at all. A jackhammer moves around. This sounds like something bolted to the ground.
That's exactly what the continuous operation suggests. A fixed machine running on a steady cycle.
The crusher ran 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. Sunday was maintenance. The only quiet day was Sunday.
Did you ever find out what the machine was doing?
Crushing concrete from a demolition site. They'd truck in slabs, feed them into the jaw, and the crusher would turn them into aggregate. The jaw was the 120 Hz source. It had a flywheel that was slightly out of balance, and the whole thing resonated.
The frequency was a mechanical defect, not an intentional design.
The engineer said it was within tolerance. The machine was supposed to run at 120. The problem was that nobody had thought about the guy in the trailer 50 feet away.
That's the story of low-frequency noise. It's always the guy in the trailer.
The company eventually moved the trailer, parked it on rubber mats. That helped a little. But by then, I'd already figured out the fan.
That's the practical lesson. The fan cost $20. The rubber mats cost thousands.
The fan was $9.95. I remember because I still have the receipt.
Of course you do. You too.
It's in the tube with the spectral plots.
Daniel's 120 Hz might not be a jackhammer at all. It might be a crusher, or a compressor, or a generator. Something with a rotating component that resonates at 120.
The measurement can tell him which one. A jackhammer would show variation as the operator moves and the tool hits different materials. A fixed machine would be locked to its operating frequency.
The all-day, everyday detail is the clue. That's not a crew with a jackhammer. That's infrastructure.
The crusher never took a lunch break.
The next measurement is the one that matters. Same setup, different time of day, loop for drift. If it's rock steady, it's a machine. If it wanders, it's a crew.
That changes the mitigation strategy entirely. A crew will eventually finish. A machine might run for years.
The crusher ran for 3 years before the demolition contract ended. I was gone by then.
Daniel's got a fan already, I'd guess. The question is whether he wants to invest in a window upgrade that might only partially help.
That's where the structure-borne measurement comes in. If he can quantify how much of the noise is coming through the window versus through the building frame, he can make an informed decision.
The trailer floor was the problem. The walls were fine. If I'd spent money on better walls, I'd have wasted it.
Which is the value of the measurement? It tells you where to spend the money.
Where not to. That's the unglamorous but useful outcome of Daniel's spectral analysis. He now knows the window is failing at 120 Hz, but he also knows there's a structure-borne component. Before he spends thousands on glazing, he can estimate whether that glazing would actually solve the problem.
The measurement is a diagnostic tool, not a solution.
That's the honest framing. Knowing the frequency doesn't make the noise go away, but it tells you what you're fighting, and it tells you where the weak points are.
I keep thinking about the coincidence effect. The idea that the window is actively resonating with the noise, vibrating like a drumhead, re-radiating the sound into the room. It's not a passive barrier that's failing. It's an active participant in the problem.
It's a sympathetic resonator. The sound pressure at 120 Hz matches the bending wave speed of the glass, and the glass starts to sing along. The window becomes a loudspeaker.
The only way to fix that's to change the window's resonant properties. Different thickness, different material, different damping.
Or to decouple the window from the sound field entirely, which is what a wide air gap does. The gap acts as a spring that isolates the inner pane from the outer pane.
The window solution is a mass spring mass system.
The design parameters are all frequency dependent. The gap width, the pane thicknesses, the damping material, all of it has to be tuned to the specific frequency you're trying to block. Daniel's measurement gives him the target frequency. A good acoustic engineer could design a window system specifically for 120 Hz.
Which is a very different conversation than, I need better windows.
It's the difference between buying a generic product and commissioning a specific solution. And the specific solution is more expensive, but it's also more likely to actually work.
The path from measurement to mitigation is, diagnose the source, quantify the paths, design a solution for the specific frequency, and accept that it'll be partial.
In the meantime, buy a fan.
The fan is the universal solution.
The fan is the one thing that always works. It doesn't reduce the noise, but it changes the perception. And perception is what keeps you awake.
Daniel's spectral analysis has given him a number, a diagnosis, and a reality check. The number is 120 Hz. The diagnosis is a window failing at its coincidence, frequency plus a structure-borne component. The reality check is that whole room ANC won't work, but a tuned window might, and a fan definitely will.
The open question is the source. Is it a jackhammer, or is it a machine? The next measurement will tell him.
If the frequency shifts over the course of a day, it's a crew. If it's rock steady, it's a fixed machine, and the mitigation calculus changes.
Because a fixed machine is a permanent problem, and a permanent problem justifies a permanent solution. A construction crew is temporary, and the right answer might just be to wait it out.
The 120 Hz signature is a fingerprint. It tells you about the source, the path, and the barrier. Understanding it's the first step, even if the fix isn't simple.
That's the thing I keep coming back to. Daniel took a phone, an app, and an AI model, and he turned a vague annoyance into a specific, quantifiable problem. That's real progress, even if the noise is still there.
The data doesn't make the noise go away, but it makes it legible.
Legible problems are solvable problems. Maybe not today, maybe not cheaply, but at least you know what you're dealing with.
I wonder what the next measurement will show. If the frequency drifts, or if it's locked at 120 all day.
That's the experiment to run. Same setup, different times, look for the drift. It's a simple measurement, but it could reveal the source's operating cycle.
That's the kind of thing that turns a noise complaint into an engineering project.
Which is very Daniel.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast.
If you've got a spectral analysis of your own noise problem, or any other weird prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us.
brush all my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.